ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 24th of June. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. The federal government is poised to see the parliament pass its much-debated changes to taxes affecting property and other assets after striking a deal with the Greens. Labor has agreed to close a property loophole for self-managed super funds and extend an inquiry into the overhaul of the National Disability Insurance Scheme. Oliver Gordon reports.
Labor's generational tax changes aimed at making the housing system fairer for young people are set to pass parliament. But in the Melbourne suburb of Pakenham, mother of three, Tanya Bowman, isn't happy.
I don't think it's fair considering Albo and all of his little cohort have already made their money off their investment properties.
The lifelong Labor voter doesn't think the government's changes to capital gains taxes and negative gearing will get her kids into a home of their own. And she's already decided she's going to throw her support behind One Nation at the next federal election.
I've got a 31-year-old that still has to live at home with his parents because he can't afford his own house. He works full-time and cannot afford to buy his own home.
And so the government's saying that they're doing this to make houses more affordable?
No, absolutely not, because all your investors are going to sell up.
And so won't that make it easier for your son to buy?
No, because he still hasn't got the income with the cost of living and whatnot. He still hasn't got the income to support a loan.
After securing the support of the Greens, the Albanese government's plans will pass Parliament this week. The changes, announced as part of the federal budget, mean that from July next year, the 50% capital gains tax discount will be replaced with a model that reduces tax in line with inflation. And the negative gearing of residential property will be restricted exclusively to new builds, whilst being grandfathered for existing property investors. Former advisor to Prime Ministers Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard, Sean Kelly, has watched the backlash to the budget closely.
I think it's always important to remember in politics that being liked isn't the only factor, it might not even be the most important factor.
The Sydney Morning Herald columnist and author isn't convinced negative sentiment about the changes will still be a major theme at the next federal election.
You have to do things that make voters look at you and think, they had a bit of backbone, they pursued their convictions, they did things that they thought were right for the country.
The Greens are supporting the changes after the two parties cut a deal that stops self-managed super funds from borrowing to purchase housing. The deal also sees an inquiry into the federal government's proposed overhaul of the National Disability Insurance Scheme extended by 8 weeks. Jared Sandal-Hay is interim president at People with Disability Australia.
There was absolutely not enough time originally for us to take a very deep look at this bill.
Labor says its changes are to make the NDIS sustainable. It will see more than 240,000 people shifted off the scheme over 4 years. Jared Sandal-Hay is fighting for more protections.
We need to go a lot further than we have so far.
Jared Sandal-Hay from People with Disability Australia, ending that report by Oliver Gordon and Pablo Vinales. A new report is warning people to be careful of harmful traps in car loans. The corporate watchdog ASIC has found some lenders are charging high interest rates and excessive fees, which can lead to big debts and vehicle repossession. ASIC says it's First Nations customers and those on low incomes who are often the worst affected. National Consumer Affairs reporter Michael Atkin has this exclusive story.
Holly Reed's stress levels begin to rise when her car repayment is coming. Each fortnight, the single mum pays $339, but it's a struggle.
I get a lot of anxiety around that week, especially if I get an extra bill come in or if rego's up. It's that uncertainty of whether or not I'm going to be able to make it through the week and have enough food to feed the kids.
The Cairns woman hasn't missed a repayment since she borrowed $22,000 from Rapid Loans in late 2024, but she's fallen behind on other bills. Holly Reed wasn't aware she'd been charged almost $5,000 in fees until she contacted a financial counsellor for help, despite it being in the contract fine print.
It kind of made me a bit emotional, to be honest.
A new report by the corporate watchdog ASIC into the car loan sector reveals common traps people like Holly are falling into. It found median interest rates as high as 22% and raised concerns over whether some lenders were charging excessive fees.
Big variations in the fees that were charged to consumers that could actually contribute to the overall value of a loan. So in the worst example we found on a loan, a total value of around $49,000, the fees themselves came up to over $9,000 of that loan.
ASIC Commissioner Alan Kirkland says consumers are often left with massive debts even after their car is repossessed.
For around 90% of those who had their cars repossessed, they still owed half of the actual loan value. That raises concerns for us about whether those loans were suitable in the first place.
Alex Price-Bush from the Indigenous Consumer Assistance Network represents Holly Reid. He's requesting a hardship arrangement to help her cope.
Holly sought the assistance of a broker to get this loan and had made some things very clear to that broker, which were not included in the assessment and should have been taken into consideration before providing her with the finance for the vehicle.
He wants more done to clean up the sector.
Anything that can be done to improve the regulation of secondhand car finance or improving consumers' experiences in general in dealing with secondhand cars would be a huge help.
Rapid Loans declined to be interviewed. The company told the ABC that all fees and charges are disclosed before a customer goes ahead, and it was assessing Holly Reid's hardship application. It added her loan application was assessed in line with the company's responsible lending obligations.
Michael Atkin and Lucy Kemp with that report. Despite best efforts to prevent suicide, in Australia, one person is still dying by suicide every 3 hours. But a world-first program known as the National Suicide Prevention Outcomes Map is being launched today with the aim of determining where the gaps are in services for those experiencing crisis and distress. Catherine Gregory reports.
Joe Riley knows all too well what can happen when people go through crisis periods in their life without the right support.
So when I was younger, I went through a period of suicidal crisis, and not long after that, my family lost my dad to suicide.
At first, Joe Riley thought something was wrong with her, but then she realised people don't come to these suicidal points in isolation.
Really, they're shaped by the conditions that we live and work in, the different pressures we carry, whether we feel connected and whether we feel that we matter.
In hindsight, Joe Riley says better services such as social or mental health support to help with life's major transitions and challenges, in addition to crisis support, could have made a difference, which is why she's been involved in developing a key component of the National Suicide Prevention Strategy, an outcomes map, which in a world first will measure success in suicide prevention.
By now pairing that quantitative data with lived experience and narrative data, we can fill the gap by showing what supports people to navigate these transitions, why those supports mattered, and what contributes to distress emerging.
The map will allow policymakers to measure the supports available for preventing people reaching suicidal distress and whether the help for those actually experiencing suicidal distress is accessible. That could look like better work-life balances, better online safety, boosting physical activity or supporting financial literacy, as well as seeing a GP regularly or carers getting mental health support.
This gives us the evidence to be able to identify what's driving the stress, what protects people, and we can then learn at scale across Australia where to invest for the greatest impact in the future.
Dr. Nicholas Proctor, Chair of the National Suicide Prevention Office Advisory Board.
So we have these numbers that go around suicide deaths, activities around service use, but we don't know about the deeper experiences when people are feeling safe, supported, connected, and whether systems are actually working the way they should before a crisis happens.
As the head of the National Suicide Prevention Office, which is launching the map, Dr. Alex Haynes explains why it's so critical to reducing rates of suicide in Australia.
And the outcomes map will help us understand the number of people that Australians feel they can call on for support during those times. It will also enable us to identify the strength of those relationships or the sense of connection to these supports, and whether this is changing over time.
The first report based on the map will be released next year.
Catherine Gregory. And if you or anyone you know needs help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. The grandfather of a 9-year-old Australian girl, Hania Emmerd, who was shot dead by police in Pakistan, is calling for justice over her death. A legal advocate says the girl was caught in a crossfire of excessive lethal force used by Pakistan's Crime Control Department. The newly established department is under scrutiny for its use of force, having killed more than 900 people in its first 8 months of operations. Kaysen Ho filed this report.
Overlooking an ordinary street in Chakwal, Pakistan, is a black billboard emblazoned with an eagle and two guns, the emblem of the Punjab Crime Control Department. It's on this street where one of the CCD's officers killed 9-year-old Perth schoolgirl Hania Emmerd. Local media shared CCTV of the moment police opened fire on the family's vehicle. They had just been robbed at gunpoint and were attempting to flee a shootout between police and the robbers. Hania was shot at least 5 times. Her grandfather, Mazar Hussain Chauhan, telling the ABC he saw her just hours earlier, smiling and happy, having dinner with their family.
I saw the dead body of my granddaughter on a stretcher, and my son and grandson were injured. Police and doctors were working. I lost consciousness. I loved her more than my own sons.
Hania's death has renewed criticisms of the Crime Control Department, which the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan says is responsible for 924 extrajudicial killings in the first 8 months of its creation last year. Pakistan's Supreme Court advocate Muhammad Azhar Sadiq has accused the CCD of bypassing the courts to administer its own justice.
This is an uncontrolled department. Uncontrolled and vague, unguided discretion has been granted to them to kill anybody, to take away life of anybody, without any reasons.
But CCD Chief Sahel Zafar Chatta maintains one of his department's key principles is the minimum use of force, telling local media Hania's death is an outlier caused by one officer's criminal negligence.
That use of force, excessive force, it led to tragic demise of a little girl and injuries to her brother and father.
The CCD is pursuing murder charges against the officer and says it's reviewing its training protocols, but it's done little to assure locals where the shooting unfolded, like Muhammad Amar.
People are scared. They're scared because they wonder if the CCD is there for our protection or targeted murders.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, is understood to have penned a letter about Hania's case to his Pakistani counterpart, Shahbaz Sharif, after last week calling for a transparent investigation into the girl's death. Hania's grandfather says he's grateful.
We want justice, no matter how. Whether we get justice because of the Australian Prime Minister or police, we just want justice.
Hania's grandfather, Mazar Hussain Chauhan, ending that report by Kaysen Ho. In Papua New Guinea, a major pipeline supplying water to the city of Port Moresby is at risk of collapsing. Residents are being urged not to panic as emergency plans to repair the pipe get underway, but the ABC can reveal claims the PNG government was warned about the issue more than a year ago, and the problems extend far beyond one leak. PNG correspondent Marion Farr reports.
In Port Moresby, residents like Kathy Sebetmin are used to making do.
Where we are, water is not so reliable.
When the taps are running, she fills containers of water to use when the pipes run dry.
Oh, it's very frustrating. Yeah, we need water every day.
The city's water infrastructure was built by Australia in the 1960s before PNG gained independence. Since then, it's hardly been maintained or upgraded, and the population has grown rapidly, according to Paul Barker, director of the Institute of National Affairs.
You have a city which is moving on to 1 million people.
Now, a major pipeline that supplies more than half the city's water has a serious leak and is at risk of rupturing. The pipe's steel walls, once 15 millimetres thick, have eroded to just 2 millimetres in some areas, with over 100 million litres of water rushing through every day. Shay Scoville from the Manufacturers Council of PNG says it's been a long time coming.
But unfortunately, sometimes it's not until you have an absolute crisis where you've got no other choice that you get the attention, I guess, of the of the government and the resource allocation, and that's the big problem.
Preparations are underway to repair the leak, with materials being freighted in from Australia, China and the Netherlands. But Paul Barker says the government should have been ready to act sooner.
Preparation is occurring now, but it's very much last minute and almost desperate preparation.
The ABC can reveal claims the state-owned entity, Water PNG, had been warning members of the PNG government of an impending water crisis for more than a year. And the problems go well beyond a single leak. Documents addressed to PNG's cabinet state that multiple critical water assets are showing signs of imminent failure, and the city's broader water network is operating under extreme and unsustainable risk, with little to no redundancy. If a failure were to occur, it could have major health, security and economic consequences. Reports seen by the ABC also claim Water PNG is effectively insolvent and is owed more than $80 million from the PNG government in unpaid water bills. Paul Barker again.
State-owned enterprises that have been managing utilities have been, frankly, poorly managed.
In response to questions, PNG's Minister for State-Owned Enterprises, William Duma, referred the ABC to Water PNG. Water PNG and its shareholder, Kumul Consolidated Holdings, have not responded to the ABC's questions. From Port Moresby, this is Marion Farr reporting for AM.
In the wake of a spate of serious and fatal attacks, a fresh shark sighting at Sydney's Bondi Beach this morning, the second in 2 days, is highlighting the role drones can play in protecting swimmers. Yesterday, a large white shark was spotted from the air by a local drone operator, forcing people to flee the water. There's been another sighting this morning, triggering a fresh scramble to alert swimmers. Nick Grimm reports.
Just 11 days after a close-to-fatal shark attack on Sydney's Coogee Beach, today another big ocean predator has been spotted close to swimmers and surfers at nearby Bondi.
All right, guys, stay out of the water again. That white shark is out there again.
Now, could you exit the water, please, and listen to lifeguard instructions?
The alarm raised by Jason Eagledon, operator of the social media account Drone Shark App. He daily patrols the skies above the waters of Bondi, keeping a watch on what lies beneath.
If anyone can yell out to those surfers in the north to get out, it's hanging around there. Lifeguards aren't operating yet.
Well done, Drone Shark.
Only yesterday, he issued the identical warning after spotting a white shark just metres from swimmers and surfers, calling his partner Angela Curry, who was herself about to enter the water. She helped warn others of the danger.
Me and my swim buddies, we thought, well, we can't really just sit on that information and not let other people know what was going on. So any swimmers that we saw approaching the water, we just said, we know there's an unidentified shark out there at the moment. So do with that what you will. Most people chose not to go in the water. And then there was also a surf school out there having lessons at the time, and they all got out too. There were some paddleboarders as well who decided to exit the water until we knew exactly what was going on.
And your partner, Jason, was able to confirm it was a white shark?
He was. It took him a while during the process. I mean, he said at the time, I'm 90% sure. And then when he was able to eventually get home, put it on the laptop on a bigger, like as a bigger image rather than his little drone remote, he could 100% confirm that was a white shark.
It comes as the New South Wales government announced in its budget yesterday that the state's shark management program will be expanded, with money allocated for smart drum lines, beach netting, listening stations and more drones in the air. But some ask if the money is better spent on ensuring drones are available throughout the day on all major beaches. Jackie Scrooby is the independent state MP for Pittwater.
Well, drones are fantastic, and yesterday is a good example that you can see a lot with a drone. Yesterday's budget announcement showed $86.6 million for the shark mitigation program, which is a huge step change. It's, I think, double. And we've also seen drones deployed through Surf Life Saving New South Wales for the last few months on our beaches. So we know the program works. My focus now is just making sure it's a program that doesn't have any gaps, that it's extended. And, you know, if you speak to any surfer who's going out for a surf this morning, surfers want, beachgoers want dawn to dusk 365 days a year.
New South Wales Independent MP Jackie Scrooby, ending that report by Nick Grimm. And that's AM for today. Thank you for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Keir Starmer is out. So, can the British Prime Minister's likely successor, the former Manchester Mayor, Andy Burnham, last the distance? Today, Simon Torme, Professor of Politics at Deakin Uni, on why Britain's woeful economy will make it hard. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.